Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Hello and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. We are back after a long hiatus, starting into the new year. This is your host, The Progeny.
And I'm the paterfamilias.
If you can't tell, we've been watching Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Also joining us today is our host, the professor from Oxford, Professor C.S. Lewis.
And a box of milk duds in front of me.
Yes, which is what we were both crashed on the couch eating milk duds. Okay, well, today we are going to change the itinerary just a little bit more than normal. Though, I guess we ought to start out by reading our comments from our last episode.
Which we love comments. Thank you for comments.
Comments are wonderful. And this was about a month ago. Should we tell them why we have been on this hiatus? Or should we just leave it to their imaginations?
Well, no, you can tell them.
Well,
if there was a reason.
We have been stopping forest fires and climbing rock wall and traveling to the Capitol to get the Senate.
Taking fire from RPGs and stuff like that.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff. Though the forest fire part was true. Okay. Anyway, back to the comments. Two comments. We have one from
our friend
Daryl Sala. And he was recommending that we watch The Lion in Winter as a Christmas movie. And it's funny that you should mention that because, actually, earlier in 2014, I had been introduced to kind of the characters of that through watching Beckett with Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole. And that, I think, was made 3 or 4 years before The Lion in Winter. But it's basically the same characters. It's Henry II and his wife, and in that movie, of course, it's Thomas Becket. And a few years later, Peter O'Toole would reprise his role as Henry II in The Lion in Winter. Anyway, I'd really like to see that because I really liked Becket.
But we don't have Netflix.
Yes, and we live in the middle of nowhere.
No, we don't live in the middle of nowhere. We are the middle of nowhere.
That's our claim to fame. Maybe that could be our motto.
Not the end of the world, but you can see it from there.
Next door to it. The other comment I will let you handle.
Oh. He says, and because, you know,
we did our last episode on Babette's
Beach. The patriarch had made not a disparaging remark, but a comment about never having attended a Catholic Mass or really, you know, knowing anything reasonably about it. And so Daryl kindly sent us a link to a Mass. And so I got to watch, I watched at least a third of that before I had to move on. But I do want to go back and catch the rest of it. I thought it was very interesting and very, I guess, at least from what I saw, very unexpected from what I, you know, very, very different from what I was expecting. I was expecting, I guess, a lot of Latin and the little things that they swing with the smoke that comes out of them.
Incense, Dad.
And that kind of thing. And they may have just been getting around to that.
That was because, you know, earlier in the year we had been watching Beckett. And They did things decidedly old school in that movie.
Well, and I was very tempted, and in fact, I do appreciate the link, and I do intend to watch the rest of it. I certainly hope to, but at the same time, I thought, well, okay, I need to post a Protestant service like I'm used to growing that I was growing up with. And there's a church near where we live, which shall remain nameless, because I don't want to, you know, any death threat. but they did have one of their services, at least in part, videotaped, and it's a hoot. I mean, it's as polar opposite from the mass that we watched, while still saying these are Christians on both spectrums, as you can possibly imagine. So I'm still playing with that idea, but you know.
Well, I would say though
there were no snakes involved. I will say that, but okay, there was lots of raised voices, shall we say.
And you know, the church we go now is honestly not very much like that, but. When I said we went to church in an office building, I wasn't kidding. Though it's not even an office building; it's more like, what, a cubicle?
Well, it's a.
It's tiny.
It's a, basically, yeah. It's probably off. It was probably intended for office space, in a strip mall. That's, you know, the space is tucked behind some other storefront. So, it would be a uncomfortable place to have to work, because there's no windows and there's hardly an outside door, but we like it there very much.
Anyway, okay, well, I guess we need to move on. We've already spent up like 7 minutes.
Chewing it up.
Yep, so we are. Well, since we've decided to move beyond movies, at least for a while, we're going to kind of talk about some of the things that were recently on the news. And since we've just passed the Super Bowl, the paterfamilias, the patriarch, had recommended that we talk about football. In particular, college football, and some of the comments that Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point,
Blink,
and David and Goliath, had made about college football.
You know, he was on the McTaxis' thing at Socrates in the City, and it was awkward at times. That those two, their senses of humor, if Gladwell has one, don't exactly overlap. it was kind of funny just watching McTaxis. It was like a cat playing with a mouse. Yeah.
There are quite a few people that will get on there and it just seems like they're not quite sure what to do with Eric Metaxas.
Yeah, those were fun to watch. Socrates in the City.
Barack Obama certainly didn't seem to know.
He wasn't on Socrates in the City.
Well, yeah, but National Metaxas did the prayer breakfast, which we'll talk about that later.
So anyway, so I'm driving home late last night, or a couple nights ago, and there's a local college, I don't know what division. I just don't know. But they have a you know, college football team, and they also have a radio station that I can pick up for about half of the distance home. So I was listening to these two folks talking about Gladwell and, you know, college football and the impact of that, and I got about halfway home and the radio station merged into a Virginia Tech station, where they were talking about the signing days, you know, or it was the sign-up days for the Virginia Tech football team. So it was, you know, it was kind of this surreal moment where you went from one group at a college that was talking about this issue, and at least a couple people, to Virginia Tech, which is obviously a big time football program, and I don't know, it just really seemed paradoxical that you know, to hear these a couple other, and from the Virginia Tech side, it was a couple guys that were talking about, yeah, this guy's, you know, 350 pounds, and he's a monster, and he's a beast, and he could do this and this, and, you know, he can run this, you know, these distances, and in this time, you know, given the times and all that. And so, but it was just really strange, and I thought, well, you know, that's an interesting topic. So, particularly one that, you know, I mean, I've always enjoyed football from a very early age. It just really resonates with me. But, you know, Gladwell's, and I should say that I've never played organized football. And, truth be told, you know, I don't know all that much about it. I've certainly watched my share, hundreds of hours of football. Still love to listen to Virginia Tech football on the radio in the fall. Professionals, not so much, particularly since the Redskins have had such a dismal record over the past 15, 20 years. But Gladwell, but I guess what has been on my mind lately, in the past few years, is just the business of football, the brutality of football, the commercialism of football, and, you know, that the whole thing has just kind of gotten lost in something. That it's obviously a big business, and, you know, there's something about that really, really bothers me.
Well, I might take the opportunity to read a little bit out of Gladwell's comment. He was talking about Michael Vick. This was back when Vick had been convicted for dogfighting and all that stuff. And he basically said, we immediately get upset when he's involved in this with dogs fighting. But he says, well, what's football? We take young boys, essentially, and we have them repeatedly over the course of the season smash each other in the head with no neurological consequences. And why do they do that? Out of an allegiance to their owners and their coaches and the feeling they're participating in some grand American spectacle. They're the same thing. And the idea that as a culture we would be absolutely quick and sure about coming to the moral boiling point over the notion that you would do this to dogs and yet completely blind to the notion that you would do this to young men is, to my mind, astonishing.
And I think that's part of it for me. I'm actually not that whole argument is builds, you know, is a portion of my, or, you know, some percentage, maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20% of what I would argue against football with. What I don't like about it is the commercialism. I had a phrase on the way home. I was thinking tonight about this podcast. I was thinking, you know, this is what I don't like about it, but I can't remember the phrase I came up with in my head. But maybe I'll think of it later. But that somehow it's changed. From when I was a boy, there was, you know, Billy Kilmer who threw dead ducks. You know, they used to do the slow motion of his football passes, and they looked like, you know, they looked like it was falling down the steps. You know, it was just going all over the place. To where now it's more of a machine, and everything is packaged. Everything is almost scripted.
Well, it's come to the point where it's almost, and I think this is kind of a broader cultural thing, we take something that can be an art or a sport or something that is about skill, and then make it about just the contest of it. There's nothing beyond winning. There is nothing beyond making money. Or, you know, I mean, you look at the even food shows. You know, it used to be where you could cook a meal, but now you have to do it on a contest on TV, where with timers and deadlines, and it's all about efficiency and not the art of it.
But the other part then that I struggle with is that I come down on the other side of this fence, which is that you got guys who are, you know, either dedicated, you know, very dedicated Christians, or are using their platform to do really good work, who are selfless and very altruistic and just really wonderful people and great role models. But I'm not so sure that's enough anymore. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of positive things that come out of football on the big scale, on the NFL side of things. There's not a lot on the college side either. I mean, it is a... I think it probably has this very garish underside to it that we are made sure that no one ever sees. You know, whether that's some...
Well, but you do see it. I mean, you think, like, with Adrian Peterson last year, you know, things like that. Just...
Well, yeah, that's right. But I'm thinking more along the lines of young men who are basically used and thrown to the side. If they twist an ankle in the middle of their freshman year, or if they break a leg, heaven forbid, something like that, you know, see ya, you know, thanks a lot. And they may, I don't know, maybe they have an opportunity to finish their degree. I don't know if that scholarship is pulled for someone else.
I was in a class last semester where there was a number of young basketball players, a bunch of young guys, and they were all, you know, they weren't particularly there to learn anything. They were there to play basketball, and it was fairly obvious that that was what they wanted to do with their lives. And that, I mean, because they were always talking about basketball. It's all about basketball, and the idea that there could be a life beyond, you know, being a professional basketball player, and it's obvious that not all of them were going to make it. It's just these young guys, they think,
right,
like they can do anything. And
as long as they can produce on the field or on the court and fill the seats, then they have value. But if they can't do that, then I, as a spectator, don't have any interest in them at all. I could care less if they have a job, what their family life is like, where, you know, what happens to them a year from now, 2 years from now. And that's, you know, that's very exploitive. I mean, it's not a good thing. It's not something to, as a Christian, that I need to, let me put it this way. I think as a Christian, that's something I need to wrestle with. Particularly when I start investing lots of time or resources into, i.e. time, you know, reading articles on the internet, and keeping up with the latest stats, you know, looking at the schedule, playing fantasy football, all those things that we say, oh, well, you know, this is just lighthearted, you know, it's just fun, you know, nobody's getting hurt. Well, I don't know.
There are people getting hurt.
Well,
it's kind of like the whole reality show thing too. I mean, you get your fame, you get up there, and you know, one minute you're the winner of American Idol, and next thing you know, if you lose whatever it is that you're supposedly valued for, you're just out in the street.
So this might have been my little diatribe. I will, one last comment, which is that I haven't been able to bring myself to wean to I have not been able to drop, close the door on football because I enjoy it so much. As I said, listening to the radio broadcasts, etc. I've thought about several times writing a little piece for the local paper, saying basically, you know, I quit. I'm not going to watch any more football. I'm going to listen to any more football, and here's why. I can't quite bring myself to do that. And I think as a Christian, that's a problem, you know, that I can't let it go. I can't, it means that much to me to where I can't say I'm going to walk away from it. And that's a big problem. So y'all pray for me, and I will, you know, of course, if the Redskins and the Hokies keep, you know, their quote unquote winning ways, it'll make this whole decision a lot easier. But
suddenly, if they, you know, make a major comeback, it's.
I know. Yeah. A few years ago, Joe Gibbs came back to the Redskins, and I was like, you know, if there's one thing that would make me get cable TV, it's Joe Gibbs coming back to the Redskins. I didn't get it, but.
Well, to end on a happy note, you know, football is not as bad as it used to be, because apparently in 1905, Teddy Roosevelt, you know, started to press for some regulation to the game because 18 people had died that year in football games. So, you know, at least we know that it's not as bad as it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, still a lot of bad knees, a lot of bad backs, a lot of guys that are having trouble getting out of bed in the morning because of football.
But speaking of heroic guys in the face of enemy fire, we're going to talk about Brian Williams now.
Take it away.
Yeah, I'm afraid.
Progeny.
Poor old Brian Williams. If any of you have been living under a rock or in a hobbit hole or, you know, in the farthest reaches of the Sahara Desert and have not heard what the deal is with Brian Williams, here's the deal. In around, I think, 2003, he was in Iraq, and he was in a chopper, and the chopper that was in front of him, by about supposedly 30 minutes, was hit by an RPG. And I don't know if it was downed or not, but that was what happened. So later on, you know, he told the story as it happened, but over the years, the story has kind of started to change until now he tells the story as that he was in the chopper that was hit by the RPG, that it went to the ground and that there was like this firefight going on. It has gotten larger in the telling, but not only that, but as that was the one that really started this whole scandal, but they've started to poke into some of his other stories over the years. There was one where he apparently caught the sentry in a hotel during Hurricane Katrina and was left in the stairwell on a mattress. And, you know, he was going to get an IV, but he refused it because he was noble, you know, and he said other people needed it more than I did. But, you know, and then he was rescued, and the only problem was that apparently, gangs had taken over the hotel.
Yeah.
And the gangs had invaded this hotel. But apparently none of this was true. I mean, none of it. Gangs were never in the hotel. He may have been a little bit sick, but, you know, it was ridiculous. So Brian Williams is the face of NBC, MSNBC, pretty much.
NBC News. Not
yeah,
news.
NBC News.
Not news.
Okay. And he is... I think he's a general editor there too.
Yes.
And more than almost anybody else, he's kind of the face of the network news community. He is for my generation, he's the trusted face on the news, the talking head, the guy that kind of comes out with the voice of God and it explains what's going on, and he's a very trustworthy person. So for this to break, it feels like it's an assault not only on him and his personal credibility, but kind of on the whole network news as an establishment. And I couldn't be more happy.
I was listening to the Ricochet Boys to talk a little bit about that today, and you know, they made the point, and it's a point well taken, that he is a news reader. You know, he's not an anchor, he is a news reader. He reads the news as it appears to him in front of him, and he's enough of an actor to make it sound credible, and that's the extent. And for that, he gets paid $10 million a year. So he's making more, you know, for each paycheck than I have saved over my entire career. So he's not getting any sympathy from me, particularly when he embellishes. Probably a kind word. Way to say it. And so
I mean, even worse, his apology was obviously not sincere, because he said he misremembered the whole thing.
Well, the problem with his apology, and I was thinking about that today, is that the big problem with his apology was that he said in an effort to honor a veteran, right, in the story. Baloney. That was not in an effort to do that. It was in an effort to make him sound bigger and better.
And more heroic.
Yes. It had nothing to do with trying to make someone else look good. I mean, in my mind, that was maybe the bigger lie, is that he tried to cover up his obvious lie with another lie that was really more reprehensible. But you know, he's lost a lot of credibility, and I have no problem with that at all, nor with Dan Rather or any of these other mainstream guys, who mainstream media fellas who try to, you know, condescend to our level with their journalistic integrity. Give me a break.
Yeah, I mean, ever since Gosnell, I just have had no use for the network news, really. I mean, even Fox News, they didn't cover that. It took forever for people to start covering that. In fact, I think it took a long time for people to start covering ISIS as well.
Well, I'll tell you this, is that one of the things that kind of opened my eyes to some of this is years ago when Matt Drudge went to the
press club,
to the National Press Club, and delivered his little address. And if you haven't seen that, you can watch it on YouTube, and it's worth the watch. It's pretty long, but for those that may not know, the National Press Club, each week they bring in a dignitary or some, you know, VIP to speak to the club, and then at the end of the session they take questions, and it's all good natured, and they give them a press club mug and pat them on their head and send them on their way. And there's clinking silverware and and cups and stuff in the background, and it's all really cool to listen to. But they bring Drudge in, and they went after him. I mean, this was shortly after, you know, the Clinton thing, I guess. And the piece is quite old, but they really went after him. You know, where did you go to school? What makes you think you can do this? What kind of how do you vet your sources? And they were really going after him. But the reality is that it's because of the internet that Dan Rathers and, quite frankly, Brian Williams's are being shown that they are not above the truth.
As well as the Gosnell trial, which wouldn't have been covered if not for the massive Twitter outrage
there,
that was going on.
Yeah.
I remember being a part of that and just being so shocked because, like, I was seeing it on Twitter, all the bloggers and everything were talking about it. But you go back to Facebook, and I mean, there's nothing. These are the people that would have gotten their news from the mainstream media, and there's nothing. There's nobody's heard anything about it.
And I don't like this whole idea of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. While we're piling on,
I actually wrote an entire article about that. I ought to publish it over at Longish.
That, you know, I was just thinking again on the way home. I was thinking about, you know, that I've been working my way up through the ranks in the news business, and I finally got the White House gig, and. You know, I've told my wife, and she's went out, and you know, the correspondence dinner's coming up, and she's, you know, I've been wanting to go for 10 years, and so she's excited. She's going to get a new gown to go, and you know, we can drop these little hints at the club. Oh, we're going to the White House for dinner, you know, next Saturday night, and there's this whole prestige thing on it. And then the next day, you're sitting at your desk, and a piece of copy comes across the desk that says something about, you know, this doesn't quite smell right for one of the White House people. You know, some story. What are you going to do? You know, are you really going to stick your neck out to go after that guy and to do what's right? Or are you going to just kind of sit back, well, maybe this can wait at least till after Saturday? That kind of thing drives me freaking nuts.
Have a milk bed.
I need a milk jug to salve my distress.
Okay. Well, I guess we can move on to the National Prayer Breakfast now, which I'm sure that you won't get at all upset about.
I didn't know we were going to talk about that.
Oh, you didn't? Okay, well, surprise. I'm actually kind of want to avoid the more obvious things that are being said about it in conservative circles, which, you know, the whole moral equivalence thing and the, you know, why does he always have to bring up the Crusades? Why does everybody bring up the Crusades? I actually want to talk about that portion of the speech in kind of a broader context and tell a little bit of a story. You know, the first semester that I was in college, I was in an English class, and I had a professor who was explaining to us the evils of Christianity and, you know, how it oppressed the people and opium of the people, that sort of thing. And he was explaining this to us, and he said that there were millions of people killed in the Spanish Inquisition. And I don't know many statistics, but I did happen to know that there weren't millions of people killed in the Spanish Inquisition. So I ended up getting into this debate with him, and eventually we got around to the fact that it was, in fact, 5,000 people that were killed in the Spanish Inquisition over a period of about 300 years, which comes out to around 15 or 16 people per year, and that it was pretty much a political thing, much more than a religious thing, but either way, you know. And of course, none of those people should have died. I don't think that killing people in the name of religion is a good thing at all. But why do you think people are so quick to believe extraordinary myths about the Crusades and about the Spanish Inquisition, when apparently, I've over the last few weeks, ever since Obama began speaking about the Crusades, I've been hearing all these pieces saying, okay, everybody says this about the Crusades, but that's not actually true. Why do you think people are so gullible about that?
Well, we just don't know our history. And I mean, I'll put my name at the top of that list. Because I don't know my history in that regard. And so it's easy to say, you know, that to me the bigger question is, or the bigger idea is, American culpability, and that this whole mindset that that we are, you know, that we're slavers, that we are oppressors, that we're misogynistic, that we beat up gay people, and we kind of wring our hands and say, well, you know, we need to be more multicultural and be more tolerant to other cultures and to listen to what they have to say. And
not to mention our worst crime, which is being founded by a bunch of dead white Englishmen.
Yes, right. And so there's this collective angst. Is this the right word?
Yeah,
About being American and that we've got to be guilty about American exceptionalism, you know. And you'll certainly have, I think, your share of folks that say, well, America's not exceptional. And I think there's, I know, I heard Tom Cotton, the new senator, Tom Cotton, just absolutely unload on this poor bureaucrat that was, you know, trying to hold the administration's line that the whole war, you know, the Guantanamo Bay is bad on the war effort. You know, in other words, because of Guantanamo Bay, the enemy uses that as a recruiting tool to bolster their ranks. Well, Cotton says, you know, well, where were they in 1993 at the World Trade Center? Where were they in Lebanon? You know, that none of those came after, or none of those were all pre-9/11, pre-Guantanamo Bay, and it was very clear that this, you know, the Islamic terrorists were going after the United States way before Guantanamo.
Well, one thing we do know is
just real quickly is that but he was making the point very clearly, very, very strongly, that there's just a bunch of baloney, you know, and the lines are very distinct. I'm sorry.
Well, there is one thing we know that terrorists have especially recently, and Al Qaeda has always used as have always used as an excuse to attack America, and that is because they say we are crusaders. So it's probably not very wise to embrace that title and, you know, and say, okay, mea culpa, you know, you bomb us and we're going to apologize. I mean, come on. It's, you know, it's... The West as a whole has a crisis of identity. We're not sure what we stand for or why we stand for it. We don't believe in anything.
No.
It's like G.K. Chesterton says, we're creating a race of men too mentally modest to believe in the multiplication table.
Yeah, and it's feeling like the 1970s when we couldn't do anything right, and when, you know, the Carter administration sent in helicopters to try to rescue the hostages in Iran, they ended up in a pile of rubble out in the desert, and the whole thing was aborted, pulled out. There were these, you know, photographs and videos, just this huge bumbling attempt at trying to do a rescue. And this was, you know, years after, not too many years after, but several years after Vietnam, so we're all just kind of, you know, what happened to America? You know, why can't we do anything right anymore? And that's when Reagan came, you know. I mean, you know, he was, say what you will about him, but that he set the American psyche back in order, you know, in that regard. That if we're going to be the world leader, we're going to act like the world leader. And that was very refreshing. I wish we had more of that now.
Well, it's like, as the professor has well observed, the whole point of trying to see through a thing is to see through it to something else. If you're, you know, if you're looking through a window, you want to see the garden beyond it. You don't want to, you're going to have to, if you're always seeing through things and things, saying, oh, I see the problem with that, there's obviously there's a fallacious argument there. If you see through everything, if everything is see-through, then it's effectively the same thing as being blind, because if you're feeling guilty about everything that America stands for, then ultimately America is standing for nothing anymore. What are you going to replace it with? You don't have anything.
Now,
it's postmodernism gone mad.
Yeah, now, all that said, as a Christian, I do have serious problems with the United States. You know, that there's no doubt about that. You know, from abortion to some of the cultural issues that we have embraced of late, that's a big problem for me. But some of the founding ideas, I hate to use this word, but here it comes. If we could get back to them. You know, I mean, they're very important. I mean, freedom of expression, you know, freedom of religion. Some of the, you know, these are very important ideas that brought America through some very difficult times.
Yeah, I think that America is not perfect, and freedom of religion and freedom of expression, all those things. I mean, they're very, very important, and I think they're the best system of government ever.
Yes.
I don't think they're perfect. I don't think they're beyond reproach completely. But if there is any reproach to be found in a nation founded on those principles, then it's not for the president to make it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to talk about America's guilt, then do it on your own time. I mean,
yeah, and I think
don't do it if you are the guy that is responsible for protecting America from terrorists, and who apparently has not done much of that very well, and is speaking on a national stage about, you know, how we need to feel guilty about things
Yes.
done thousands of years ago.
I'm very curious to see in the 2016 election how much of that comes through, how much of that people are really just tired of hearing about America kind of getting, you know, run down from the bully pulpit. That'll be interesting to watch. Because you'll have, on the right, you're going to have, you know, somebody like Marco Rubio, who's just going to be, like, championing America and its ideas. Versus, you know, quite frankly, kind of a Oh boy, you know, here we go again. you know, beating up the whole that the we've got to be more multicultural and more embracing to other people, cultures, and their ideas.
Oh yeah, what's the capital of Saudi Arabia?
That's right, man.
Okay, well, I guess we probably ought to move on to more cultural matters. Speaking of culture, we were going to talk about kind of our best of lists for 2014, the best TV we watched, best movies we watched, best books. You want to get us started off with your favorite books?
Favorite books?
Yep.
Well, I listen to a lot of books on CD in my commute, so there's a couple of these are probably from there. And that, you know, we need to talk about that sometime is we ought to do a episode on some of the better books on CD or electronic books because some of the readers can really bring those to life, or they can sinker, you know, they can really make those come alive. But anyway, my best of, where's my list at?
Brave New World.
Brave New World. I listened to that one. That's one I listened to. And that's pretty disturbing. You know, I mean, it's disturbing in that the drug of choice in Brave New World is Soma, I think. And I just couldn't help thinking about, Prozac, you know, or some of the other mood-altering drugs that are so prevalent in our society today, Ritalin, and we're gonna medicate rather than get to the bottom of maybe the real issue with these kids or with these people, or look for other ways to solve the problem. You know, why don't you talk about the 1984, how it was versus Brave New World?
Well, I haven't read 1984. However, I'm kind of generally familiar with the story. I think it was Larry Taunton on Twitter that was basically saying that 1984 is a dystopia where people are controlled by power, by oppression, by tyranny. And Brave New World creates a place where people are controlled by pleasure, by indulging their every desire.
And that's exactly right. And it's frighteningly accurate. I mean, I've listened to both of those in the past few years. I listened to 1984 probably 3 years ago. And you know, and it's definitely disturbing. I've heard that folks that were in, you know, the gulag and stuff, that when they listen to 1984, they just about, it's about all they can do to handle it, and I could see why. But for me, Brave New World was a little more scary, because it was just like people just apathy run amok. I mean, people just truly didn't care as long as they had their soma, as long as they had their fix. They just check out, and I see that in a lot in American culture today. As long as the milk shows up on the doorstep, and I've got Netflix and I've got a bag of Fritos, I don't really care about anything else. You know.
Well, I'm going to skip ahead to mention one of the books that is on my list, and that's also by G.K. Chesterton. It was called The Napoleon of Notting Hill, and in some quarters, it's considered to be the template for 1984. Because it also takes place in 1984, but it's a Chestertonian dystopia, which means it's a happy dystopia where everybody's miserable, but everybody's merry in the end. Very bizarre little story. It's about a society where people are elected by lottery to be king, and people, they don't care at all about democratic process anymore. It's just like whoever wins, you know. The fellow that happens to win this year is a guy who has very fanciful notions about what it means to be a king. So he makes all of his chief advisors, who, you know, wear their suits and everything, he makes them stop wearing suits but start wearing tunics and cloaks and
that'd be fun.
And swords at their side. And he has his guards and dressed up in gaudy colors and with halberds and that sort of thing. But then one young man who he's been, you know, actually takes him seriously. And his name is Adam, and he comes in and he says, well, he says, you told me that I needed to die to defend my neighborhood if I needed to. And his neighborhood is Notting Hill. And he says, so I'm going to. He says, they want to build a pipeline through my neighborhood, and I don't want them to do it, so I'm going to, he basically says he's going to secede, and he organizes the neighborhood watch, and they're going to fight the rest of the country. It's not quite like anything else I've ever read. It's kind of about characters waking up from apathy. And Chesterton's seeming answer to that is to be devoted to some sort of object, to kind of have a sort of patriotism, to love your country or your home or the qualities of your home. And it's a really interesting novel. I highly recommend it.
I think there's a quote that I've ran across once. I think it goes, ignorance and apathy are signs of a dying nation. And I think that's true. And I don't know what it'll take to get the United States out of that, just this total apathy that we have. But I shudder to think of what it'll take. Really do. Probably $5 a gallon gasoline would be a good start.
Yeah, if people start going all the Tale of Two Cities in the streets, that would be a bad sign. All right, well, the second one on your list is Gilead by Marilyn Robinson.
Yes, I listened to that too. Actually, it was Irish Anglo Murders. But Gilead, that was a nice book. And I listened to it. This terrific reader. I mean, he really brought it to life, and just was a perfect fit for that book. And it's a sweet book. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of deeper meaning there that I didn't pick up on. And it had some interesting themes in it. That I really liked, but I think it's just at the end of the day, it was for me, it was just a good read, and it was a lot of a very sweet book. But I think, I don't know what I'd rank it. We'll have to talk about that sometime. But
I really enjoy it too. I read that for the first time this year. It's about this elderly pastor. And the reader was so good that I kind of felt like he was just kind of this elderly man sitting in the car next to me, because I would drive back and forth to school, and he was just sitting there rambling on and telling me these stories, because it's written in second person, which is just lovely. You know, it just feels like he's having a conversation with you.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things about the book was the importance that it placed upon the act of blessing someone. And I just thought And that's kind of the climax of the book, is a blessing that's given.
You're right.
In a lovely setting,
That's one of the President Obama's favorite books.
It is, which is one of the few things I agree with him on.
So when I next time I meet him, I'm going to bring that up.
Yes, that will be like the one topic of conversation I can strike up with him without arguing.
How about that Tom Cotton, I might say.
So the Crusades. I have some information about the Crusades that I want. I just wanted to set some of your facts straight.
Yeah, I've got some ideas for the new uniform that the soldiers should wear.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
put an American flag on one side and a cross on the other. How about that? What does that sound like?
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's since we're on the topic of audiobooks, and I'm going to talk about an audiobook which is quite different from that one. which is on my list because I read it for the first time this year on your recommendation. It's a book by a lady named Ruth Dudley Edwards. It's a murder mystery. It's called The Anglo-Irish Murders.
And it's not a murder mystery. It's a...
But more than a murder mystery, it's a social satire, political satire.
Yes, wrapped in a mystery.
The mystery gives her an excuse to drop two of her characters at a Anglo-Irish relations conference where this baroness named Jack Troutbeck, is trying to resolve the issues of the country with all the tact of a sledgehammer. There's a whole list of caveats that I have, you know, going through my head right here before recommending it. It is highly not safe for work, but it is about the funniest thing I have read all year.
Not safe for work.
Not safe for work means like language and stuff. Yeah.
Yes, it
you
has.
You haven't heard that expression?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
It has language and it has.
Jack is a lady of various tastes.
Yes, but she is, and she's a Tory, in the, you know, most rigid sense.
Yeah.
And it's just delightful to listen to her. Absolutely bulldoze some poor, you know, poor snob.
The mopes. The most depressed people ever.
And it's a hoot.
You really must listen to the audiobook because I just can't picture doing it any other way.
No, I agree.
Okay, so
what's his name? Wallace?
Bill Wallace.
Amazing.
Passed away 2 years ago, which is unfortunate.
What a loss, yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, the last book on my list was The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, who was a well-known 20th century Catholic writer. There were two really, really well-known writers, him and Evelyn Waugh, who kind of formed an entire genre all to themselves. It's not quite like anything you'll ever read. Waugh is, of course, best known for *Brideshead Revisited*, but Graham Greene is better known for kind of spy capers, and he wrote several Hollywood movies. *The Power and the Glory* is set in Mexico during the Revolution. It's about a priest who, and now during the Revolution, they were kicking all the priests out of the country or executing them or something along these lines. But this one priest is left in this one section of Mexico, and he's traveling from village to village, giving the Eucharist to people who, of course, in Catholicism, you can't have the Eucharist without a priest there. So it's kind of this deal where every village he comes to, people just flock to him. They have to, because he brings life with him. He brings the bread and the wine, and but the thing is, he's an alcoholic, this guy. He's completely a sinner, and you know he's fallen, and there's very little to admire about him. He's a coward. He's all these things, but he keeps on going, and he keeps on doing these things, and he's against all of his better instincts.
It might be Christopher Hitchens.
What? Okay, but he's. It's like he keeps on trying to run away from his mission in this poorest of all places, but grace keeps on dragging him back and back and back and back, and it's a lovely story. It's very tough to read at times, but more than anything, it is about grace, very unmerited grace, but grace all the same.
Amazing grace.
Well, I mean, amazing grace, you know, yeah.
Amazing, even. I was just thinking about that little video with Hitchens there in the back seat of the car with what's his name?
Douglas
Wilson. That's a great little piece. I love that little video.
I'll link to it in the show notes.
The look on Hitchens' face when he's explaining that is just priceless. I just love it.
He's talking about the one most convincing argument for God that he can think of. It's a really interesting clip. Anyway, to move on to TV and movies, because we are the Pilgrims Podcast. My favorite movies of 2014. You've already talked about Babette's Feast and The Godfather, but they would probably make it into my top 4 or 5. I really, really enjoyed them. There's a movie called Ordit, which is by Carl Theodore Dreyer, and I'm hoping that we can review that around Easter time, so I won't talk about that very much. The others would be A Man for All Seasons, starring Paul Scofield. It's from 1966, and it's about Thomas More, and it's a remarkable movie. I really enjoyed it. It's basically about religious freedom. It's about a guy who, Thomas More, who stood up to Henry VIII, who wanted to divorce his wife, and in the process of wanting to divorce his wife, he decided to basically excommunicate himself from the Church of Rome and the entire rest of his country, take it out of the Church of Rome, and that was the English Reformation. And Thomas More was not having any of it, and that the movie is about him, and it's really a one-man show, because Scofield is just such a remarkably forceful and intelligent actor. It's a performance for the ages. The other movies, I really enjoyed A Room with a View, which you can find on Hulu. And there's one more movie which the Patriarch thought it was the best movie.
I was not a fan, except for the pool, the pond scene.
The pond scene. Yeah, that did kind of spice things up a little bit.
Yeah.
Speaking of things that are not safe for work, the pond scene.
Not safe for work. I have to remember that.
Okay. And speaking of a movie that is not safe for work, that I probably should not mention, Midnight Run. I really like that. Okay. All right, moving on. TV. I wanted to talk a little bit, you know, just before we end up here, we're going to have to wrap it up because we're about to come into our time. Kind of a few of the TV shows in 2014 that I really liked. And one of those wasn't introduced to in 2014, but it did end in 2014 after 25 years, and that was Agatha Christie's Poirot, starring David Suchet. And you know, my watching the last episode, my childhood was just withering and dying inside of me. I couldn't even really engage with the episode until the second time I watched it, because I was just like, I can't deal with this. I really can't deal with this. No.
She was raised on Poirot.
I was.
And Jeeves and Wooster. That explains a lot.
Yeah, Poirot, I remember that was probably one of my earliest memories, was you guys downstairs watching Poirot, and I was too young to watch it.
Yep.
And then, of course, I wasn't too young to watch it, and then I watched it for years and years and years, and then, you know.
And then he died.
Spoiler alert. So, yeah. Okay. Poirot, that's a really good series. All 25 years of it, you ought to check it out. And the other series, which I was introduced to in 2014, I think, was Broadchurch. And that was my favorite TV show of 2014, and it was not The Patriarchs, but that's just because he's wrong. Kind of, it examines the question, how much you really know the people who are around you, and how much of your life is built on the trust that you build with those people, and if they end up betraying you, then what have you got left? In the story, there are two examples of that, and one person ends up just kind of having his or her life destroyed at the end of the series because everyone that they trusted has been lying to them. And especially the person they trusted the most has been lying to them, and that person really just has no recourse, no hope. And then on the other hand, you have a couple of people who, through the medium of the church, have managed to find reconciliation and peace, despite the fact that they know
that those other people have lied to them. The fact that they know the truth.
You know what I was watching when I was her age on TV? Gilligan's Island reruns. And I was thinking the same things.
Yep, the secret connection between Gilligan's Island and Broadchurch.
What is the existential idea that they're trying to get across to me here with Gilligan and this gorilla?
I haven't even seen an episode of that, though, but I...
Well, okay. We need to rectify that, don't we?
Yeah, okay, well, the last TV show, and the last thing we're going to talk about, is Life on Mars.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
which may be your favorite TV series of 2014.
Maybe.
You want to describe it, or shall I?
You go ahead. I've been talking too much.
No, I've been talking about movies for the past few minutes.
It's like this.
Okay, maybe I should.
I was born in 1964, and I grew up in the 70s, and there was nothing good about the 70s. But this show maybe made me rethink that a little bit. Because there was justice in the 70s, except for Jimmy Carter. This guy gets hit by a car and he wakes up in 1973 in London.
Sam Tyler gets hit by a car in 2006. And he wakes up in 1973. Okay.
He's a police officer, and he ends up with a, you know, the Gene Hunt, who's the bad guy on Horatio Ormore. I'm trying to remember his name on Horatio Ormore.
Hobbs.
Mr. Hobbs. That's it. He ends up working for Mr. Hobbs, and it's just great. And there's sideburns, and there's smoking. There's lots of smoking, and there's really bad music, and really bad clothes, and really bad hair.
And sexist comments, all sorts of really, really politically incorrect.
And it's hippies getting punched, and, you know.
That was your favorite part.
And it's just, there's threats, and police brutality, and... It's a wonderful thing.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is our Christian program.
Yeah. Sure. Now our lawyers will be contacting us now.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've already recommended Anglo-Irish Murders and Midnight Run. Can it get any worse?
Life on Mars.
Yeah.
Check it out.
It's about political correctness and the lack thereof.
It's about as politically incorrect a TV show as you could possibly ask for in this day and age.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You can find it on Hulu at times, though I would warn you that there are several episodes that have scenes that you might want to skip. If you were under a certain age.
Or go back and watch again.
Okay, well, before we take this show any deeper, you know...
If you're under a certain age...
Gosh, all right. Let's end this while we were still a little bit behind and not... Okay, what's our... All right. This has been the Pilgrims Podcast. Thank you for joining us this week. You can find us online at the Pilgrims Podcast blog. You can find us on Twitter, Longish and Growboy. You can actually find our new Pilgrims Podcast Twitter account as well. You can find us at Longish and What's He That Wishes So? If you have any comments on the show, you can leave them at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com or on the blog, and we'll address them in our next episode. So
please do. Yes. Leave comments.
Right before we sign off, what are we doing next week? We're talking about westerns. Talking about Clint Eastwood and westerns.
That's right.
Yes.
You got a problem with that?
You feeling lucky, punk?
That's Dirty Harry.
Oh, was it? Okay.
There's two kind of men. There's two kind of men in this world. There's the shovel, and there's the donkey.
you just butchered that quote. Okay. Let's end this. Well, until next week. Don't misremember anything.
Don't misremember.